Lasso. So I want to begin on an utterly practical and mundane note, and that is when you all come to 2327 for your weekly meetings with me, please do not hesitate to knock. I think we're all pretty much synchronized in terms of our clocks, but don't wait for me to call you. Just feel free to knock, but you really only need to knock once, because I've not gone anywhere, and I'll hear you the first time. And if I don't respond immediately, that's probably because you're a little bit early, and I'm writing up somebody else's, my notes about the earlier person or what have you. But please do knock, and knock once, and that should be quite sufficient. Okay? Hola, so. Now you know what hola, so means. Yeah? Nothing at all. So now we begin for the afternoon, once again, the cycle of 10, coming back to loving kindness, very much in the spirit of the Buddha's own teachings of directing loving kindness for oneself, first of all. And if this was relevant, which it clearly was during the time of the Buddha, then all the more relevant now that this disease of modernity, of low self-esteem, self-loathing, and all of that has become so endemic. As we engage in the meditative cultivation of each of these four, now you've been through the cycle twice, it's the four, and then the variations on the theme as I've chosen to highlight them. Clearly, the role of imagination, when I say now let your imagination play, go into the realm of imagination and so forth, then, of course, it's time to bring things to mind, people's images, the faces of people to mind and so forth. And a sheer fact of human nature is some people are just naturally more gifted for visualization than others. So artists, contractors, architects and so forth tend to be quite naturally gifted. They can do it easier. That may be one reason they became artists or architects, because they are good at it. And other people, I know one Western scholar of Tibetan Buddhism, he's outstanding, really a first-rate scholar. He tells me he just can't visualize anything. You say it, visualize a ping pong ball. Nope. No ping pong ball, nothing. You know, and this person is very, very intelligent, so it's not an issue of how intelligent, it's just a gift. Like some people are good at music, some people are good at mathematics, some people are good at visualization. The point of mentioning this is that in this group here, there are undoubtedly people more or less gifted in visualization, but that does not mean by any means that if you're less gifted in visualization, that you're less gifted for cultivating the four immeasurables. Okay, there's no correspondence there. And so as we venture into the practice this morning, and I think you can anticipate where we're going, and I invite you to imagine, it doesn't have to be with much mental imagery. So let's just start with the first one. I'll give the guided meditation. And as I mentioned this morning, we'll go through this cycle one more time, so 10 days. At the end of those 10 days, if a majority of you feel, maybe we can take a rest now and just have quiet meditation, that'd be fine. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But I think one more cycle, hopefully, will be helpful. But you know where we'll begin. And that is, I'll invite you to envision your own flourishing, your own well-being, your own vision of what would bring you the deepest, greatest sense of satisfaction, sense of meaning, of happiness, joy. What is your heart's desire? That's one way I like to phrase it. What is your heart's desire? Well, as you do this, some of you may be able to really draw forth a fountain of imagery, of imagination coming together. What would you really love to see happen? How do you love to see your life unfold and so on? For some people, it may come with a very clear imagery. But whether or not it does, to simply ask, like speaking to your own heart, what would make you really happy? And to reflect upon that, to rest with that, and see what comes to mind. It doesn't have to be with much imagery, but to envision, to expand your vision, to deepen your vision of what it means for you to flourish. And I think this is an area where the Buddha Dharma, among other contemplative traditions, really has so much to offer, and other wisdom traditions too, the ancient tradition of eudaimonia in Greek philosophy. But in so many schools, systems of education, so many, when students are being educated all the way through postdoctoral, they never even hear the word eudaimonia. They never hear the notion that it might be possible to flourish, to find a sense of well-being and satisfaction that's not hedonic. I don't think I'm wrong. You could go through 20, 25 years of education and never even hear that you might actually find happiness in ways that are not contingent upon outside situations turning out right, right? So just there, to envision what would it be like to flourish eudaimonically in terms of genuine happiness, tapping into your own wealth, into your own inner resources. And now that we've gone into more than three weeks of this retreat, quite a number of you are getting these glimmerings from your substrate consciousness, a sense of serenity, a sense of overall well-being, of bliss coming up, luminosity, brightness, clarity coming up. It's not uncommon. I've been listening to you, all of you now, one-on-one for more than 3 weeks. And so you're already tapping into, all of you to varying degrees, tapping into your own resources. And as you do so, that gives fuel for the imagination. Fuel, well, if this is what I could experience in 3 weeks, what would it be like, you know, to really fully bring to the light of consciousness these inner resources from substrate consciousness or even from the greatest step, from Rigpa, pristine awareness itself. So I think this is one of the great contributions of the contemplative traditions, the wisdom traditions, so needed in this modern world, which is so fantastically expert and sophisticated at promoting the hedonic. I mean, really, the advertising industry, I don't think it's ever been as good as it is right now. It's fabulous. It's captivating, intoxicating to see, wow, I just had that car. I can hardly wait. I just got to have that ultimate driving machine or that car or this. I mean, it's really fantastic. They are so skillful at manipulating us and sucking us dry. You know? And that's what the advertising industry is all about, to sell their product to us so they make profit. And here's something where there's no profit for anybody. It's tapping into your own inner resources and they're already yours. So as the weeks go by, as the months and years go by, as you are tapping more and more deeply into your own inner resources, then let the blossom of your own vision, of your flourishing, just start expanding. A time to dream. So that's what this session really is. It's a time to dream. And whether it's with a lot of imagery or very little imagery, but Martin Luther King had a dream, became very famous. Gandhi had a dream. Thomas Edison had a dream. You know, the people who shaped the modern world and the ancient world, they had a dream of something that wasn't real yet. And they dreamed it, and the dream became actuality. I would say something quite locally here. Oh, what was it, Klaus? Maybe only 4 years ago. I think this was a dream, wasn't it? 4 years ago, I think. 3 years ago. About 3 years ago, Klaus took me to this chunk of dirt out here. And it was just dirt, red dirt with a bunch of weeds on it. And he showed me, and this is where the library will be, and this is, and he pointed to another piece of dirt and said, this is where the meditation hall will be. We looked at another piece of dirt. It actually looked a lot like the other pieces of dirt. And he said, this is where the dining hall is going to be. And I think he could visualize it better than I could. Because I was pretty much seeing a lot of dirt, right? And the school was barely up, just a couple of buildings. The sports facility, forget about it, nothing there at all. But there was a dream, there was a vision, and now we're seeing it coming to fruition. So that's for a community, a matrix here. And now what I'm inviting you to do, and we'll go directly to meditation, is allow yourself to dream, to venture beyond anything you've ever experienced in the past, to not limit yourself by your own past history, but allow yourself to be flamboyant, allow yourself to be irresponsible, allow yourself to have an adventure of dreaming. What would bring you real satisfaction? What is your heart's desire? And then wish it for yourself as your best friend. As your best friend. Wish it for yourself. And then envision as Klaus, for just taking an example, Klaus had the vision, but then I think there was a bit of hard work after that, unless I'm mistaken. I think there's a bit of hard work. I don't think it's quite finished yet. But actually making it happen. But if the vision is there, there's a real possibility of it taking place, and if the vision's not there, there's zero chance of it taking place. So the vision, the dream is there first, and that's what I'm inviting all to do now. Dream your own life. Be a dream weaver of your own flourishing. Okay? Let's jump in. But as our first act of loving kindness in this session, begin the session in this inviting, soothing fashion of letting your awareness descend into and fill the body, settling the body in its natural state, letting the breathing flow in its natural rhythm, and settling your mind, calming, soothing your mind, this troubled, discursive, agitated mind. Calm and soothe it with mindfulness of breathing. Now, as we venture into the meditative cultivation of loving kindness, I invite you to let your imagination loose in the realm of possibility. As we have perhaps 40 people here this afternoon, let there be 40 individual and unique meditations. As you listen to your own heart, ask of yourself, what would make you truly happy? The greatest sense of fulfillment, of meaning. Wherein lies your greatest happiness? With or without much imagination or visualization, bring to mind, what would bring you genuine happiness? What would it be like realize it? And then embrace, if you will, this extraordinary assertion from the Buddhist tradition, but also other traditions. And that is that the deepest dimension of your being, which we here call pristine awareness, primordial consciousness, that this is the deepest source, the root of your yearning for happiness and your wish to be free of suffering. This is its ultimate source. Imagine this dimension, primordially pure dimension of your awareness, symbolically as an orb of light at your heart, and with each out-breath, as you hold this vision of your own flourishing in mind, imagine, if you will, a cascade of light emerging from this orb of light at your heart, filling your body, saturating your mind, as with each out-breath, you arouse the yearning, may I be truly well and happy. May I realize my heart's desire. And breath by breath, imagine realizing here and now the fulfillment of your own aspirations. And now, in order to realize your own deepest longing, it should be quite clear and obvious there's no way to realize that entirely on your own with no help from outside. So raise a sweat second question now, if you will. In order to find the happiness and the fulfillment that you seek, what would you love to receive from the world around you? From the people close to you, and from those who are distant, from the environment itself, from teachers and friends, what would you love to receive to enable you to realize your heart's desire? And with each in-breath, in the same spirit of loving kindness, with each in-breath arouse this yearning, may I receive all that I truly need from moment to moment, from day to day, from the world around me. May I receive all that I truly need to find genuine happiness and fulfillment. With each in-breath, imagine, if you like to play with your visualization, your imaginative abilities, imagine all that you need converging in upon you in a form of light, filling your whole being with every in-breath. And imagine here and now receiving all that you truly need. Truly need for your genuine happiness. Not the fulfillment of every hedonic desire. That won't happen. Reality doesn't cooperate. But for your yearning for genuine happiness. Imagine that reality rises up to meet you. From moment to moment, day to day. And imagine receiving all that you truly need. In order to realize your own fulfillment, to manifest your highest and your deepest potential. It is just as obvious that this will never take place simply by having a great deal of assistance, blessings, help from outside. There must be inner transformation, a spiritual evolution, maturation, if you like. So in this exactly the same spirit of loving kindness, wishing yourself well, imagine now, in order to find genuine happiness, from what qualities of mind and qualities of behavior would you love to be free from mental afflictions, unwholesome behavior that impedes, that blocks you in your realization of genuine happiness? From what would you love to be free, and with what qualities would you love to be imbued Envision your own maturation, your own growth towards the realization of your dream. With each out-breath, arouse the yearning, may it be so. With each out-breath, imagine light once again flowing from your heart and transmuting your whole being, shaping yourself. As the Buddha said, like a fletcher shaping an arrow, like a potter shaping a pot. Imagine shaping yourself. So that you may realize your heart's desire. With each out-breath, imagine this transformation taking place here and now. Finally, in the same spirit of loving kindness, in order to imbue your own life with as much meaning as possible, and we must be aware of the fact that our very existence as individuals is utterly intertwined with the lives of those around us, our fellow human beings, other sentient beings, the natural environment. We all exist in interdependence. So in order to bring the greatest meaning to your life, the greatest sense of satisfaction and fulfillment, imagine now what kind of a mark would you love to make on the world? What is the greatest good you can imagine bringing to the world? In short, what would you love to offer to the world, to those around you, to those who are near and far, in the short term and the long term? So that at the end of the life, you'll look back upon the life with a deep sense of satisfaction and the knowing this was a life well lived. And with each out-breath, and let your imagination run wild. Imagine offering what you would most love to offer, drawing on your own unique background, your talents, your resources, your vision. What is your unique contribution that you would love to make to the world? That the world will become a better place because you've been here. Envision it, and with each out-breath, imagine offering it here and now. Imagine those around you receiving the goods that you have to offer. Imagine the joy you may bring, the relief of suffering and difficulty that you may bring about. Let your awareness rest. In utter simplicity, let your awareness rest in stillness, gradually coming to rest in the core from which all of these aspirations arise. Let's bring this session to a close. So I hope it's very clear at this point that the cultivation of loving kindness for ourselves, and then of course as we extend it outwards, loving kindness for others, that it very much takes into account and embraces the importance of the realization of hedonic well-being. If people are hungry, they don't want a meditation class. They want food. If they're cold, if they lack shelter, and so forth. To meet those, the hedonic needs is so enormously important. And everybody who's had experiences in life where the hedonic needs have not been met knows how important they are, right? But once they have been met, then that's the big fork in the road. And one of the most intriguing aspects of human existence is that people can have all of their hedonic needs met. I mean, every single one of them, all met, and still dissatisfied. Whether it's wealth, whether it's fame, whether it's physical beauty, whether it's power. We have such a wealth of information about history now. And we know immensely powerful people, immensely wealthy and gorgeous, and people with just sensual opulence, just everywhere around it, just flooding themselves with sensual pleasures, and still dissatisfied. Still looking, still, what next, what next? Something new, what's new, what's new? That, to my mind, is one of the most inspiring aspects of human existence. Because if we are really satisfied, then they say, okay, I guess that's what we're here for. If that would really do it, you know, get enough money, enough sex, enough power, enough prestige, enough people loving you and admiring you. And if people would say, this is just fine. Then it's okay, that's where we topped out. But it's so inspiring to me when I find the people who are just have won the samsara lottery and they're still dissatisfied. That makes me so happy. They say, there's something more. There's something, and we don't have to win the samsara lottery. We don't have to be, you know, the Academy Award winner, et cetera, et cetera. We can start right there and say, what's it all for? And so the realization, the experience of meeting all of our hedonic needs is a stepping stone to pursue genuine happiness and finding that's really what it's all about. So one of the most magnificent hypotheses that I think anyone has ever come up with, and it's not any one person who's come up with it, but it comes especially from the contemplative traditions of the world, and that is that reality itself, this universe, is in such a way that it arises to meet us in that gradient insofar as we align our aspirations, our priorities, our way of life, our conduct to the pursuit of genuine happiness. Terrible things happen to great contemplatives, hedonically. They can be tortured, they can be imprisoned, all kinds of terrible things can happen. Happens throughout history. Very religious people, saintly people, compassionate people, still terrible things happen to them. Hedonically, no guarantee that things will just be more pleasant for you. But in terms of genuine happiness, the more oriented one's aspirations, one's values, one's priorities, one's whole way of life towards the cultivation of genuine happiness, and the greater wisdom one cultivates in terms of skillful means to realize it, not just having it as an ideal, but actually skillful means to develop it, the extraordinary hypothesis is to just check it out and see, does reality rise up to meet you? Or is it just karma? Or is it just random, great big mindless machine? There are multiple hypotheses out there. But this one there, this one, insofar as you're oriented to genuine happiness, does reality rise up to meet you step by step along the path? In my experience, it's like trying to cross a stream, at least quasi-blindfolded, and just kind of tentatively putting a foot out, and then finding, lo and behold, a stone rose right where my foot was about to come down. And then I go, oh, let's go to another foot. And, oh, another stone rose right where my foot was coming down. Another foot, another stone comes up. And yeah. When I went off to India when I was 71, that was it. In 1971, that was it. I didn't know what I was getting into. I was 21 years old. Didn't know nothing. I had one contact in India. It's a rather large country. And I just went out there blind, having spent all my money for a one-way ticket on an airplane, and kind of went, and arrived in Dharamsala, and a stone came up and met me. And then another, and then my visa ran out in 2 weeks, because I was such a dumbbell, I didn't think about getting a visa. And then a stone rose up to meet me. And then I just had a whole bunch of stones ever since. Okay. So that's just one narrative, a very short version of the narrative. But it's a magnificent hypothesis to put to the test. So there we are. How's your practice going? Any insights, observations, questions, or comments? Anything coming up? Or shall we have a short afternoon? Oh, we'll begin with Rhonda and then on to Sandra. Thank you, Lizzie.
I was wondering if you could elaborate more about the kalpa you were talking about this morning.
The kalpa? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I found the impression of the thought image had a very steadying influence on the meditation. Yeah. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more about the use of that imagery in stabilizing meditation and how you might use it.
How you might use imagery.
Yes.
As in, like, visualizing a Buddha image and focusing on that? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, the example this morning was the submarine.
Oh, yes, right.
And so when I went and practiced that, I literally had this energetic thing of sinking down.
Yeah.
And the only experience I had was of the breath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just stayed there. And the only thought that came to my mind was, if I wanted to, I don't think I could get up.
If I wanted to, I?
Couldn't get up.
You couldn't,
I was just there. And the breath slowed down to sort of minuscule.
Yeah.
And because of that very steadying effect of that image, I was wondering if that's something that's commonly used as a tool in meditation.
Yeah. I'm going to respond, as I so often do, in parallel way, because I always like analogies. It just broadens and contextualizes. So I'll start with the analogy, and then I'll go right to your question. But some of you might know this story. When I was in a very, very, very solitary, quite intense six-month retreat in the high desert in eastern California, up in the mountains, a number of years ago, and coming down just about once a month down to the nearest public telephone, and would speak with my teacher, Gyatro Dhammachi, and then heard right back up. So it was almost entire solid for 6 months. At one point, he told me, because he was living about 1,000 miles away, but I would get him on the telephone. He said, "Alan, you're practicing with too much desire." Remember that story? Practicing too much desire. And my basic response was, "No, I'm not. I'm really practicing. I'm not. You know, it's not sex, not money. Those are the two big ones. Neither one. I'm just not. You know, I'm just practicing. You know." And I don't know exactly what I said to him. It's, no, I'm not talking about desire for sex or mundane things, fame and wealth and all that kind of business. No, you're practicing with too much desire for the practice. And then I had to plead guilty. Because I tend to be, you might have noticed I get enthusiastic once in a while. It happens, you know. And I can have a pretty steady, pretty powerful current of enthusiasm for practice, which means kind of eager beaver, you know, like that. And he said, "Cool it. You know, you're practicing with too much desire for the practice and for the outcome of the practice. And when you're practicing, just release the desire and just do the practice. But, you know, chill, relax, cool it. Just do the practice." But then, of course, I had to come back and say, "Yeah, but what about all those discursive meditations, the forethought that turn the mind, that are designed to completely invert your mind away from mundane concerns and give you this passionate yearning for liberation? That's desire. What about bodhicitta? That's desire." And what all the prayers to the gurus and so forth, the guru lineage, that's desire. So what are you telling me to have no desire for when the renunciation is desire, bodhicitta is a desire, prayers to the guru are desire? There's desires all over the place. Now you tell me not to have any desire. So what's up with that? You know, I give a little bit of lip, but I did it in a respectful way. And he said, in between sessions, have as much desire as you like. But when you're actually in formal practice, leave the desire, like leaving your shoes outside the meditation hall. Leave your desires there, and then just do the practice. In between sessions, go ahead. Develop your enunciation, bodhicitta, your vision, your all of that. So go ahead, aspiration, motivation, all of that, very good. But when you're actually practicing, just do the practice. So there's the analogy. To come back to your question, there are a lot of images. There are a lot of nice images. I mean, some I've made up, and many of them come from the tradition before me. A falcon kiting into the wind. Isn't that a lovely image? It's gorgeous, right? But should you be holding that image when you're actually practicing settling the mind in its natural state? No, that's grasping, right? The old man watching other people's children play. Okay, the bashful maiden, the submarine that goes down. And I've probably given a lot more images. And one I'm not going to use anymore. When you are just sitting there being present with no object, and then after some time it's like the sun rising behind you and you become aware of awareness itself. So many people now are thinking, where's the corona? Where's the corona? Is it yellow? What color is it? Where's the sun? You know, so I'm not going to use that anymore. It seems to be more distracting. So image that was useful for me, but I think not so useful for other people. So the short answer now, finally, after the long prelude, is the images can be very helpful. But use them as with the desire, as the aspiration. Use the images also as a preamble. Maybe just when you're going into the practice. What's the ambience? As I'm about to settle the mind in its natural state. What's the feel? What shall I bring to this? Bring to it an old woman, much older than you, an old woman sitting on a park bench watching other people's children play. How mellow. You know, old granny, old grandma, just watching other people's children play, just watching them have a fun time and like that. So with interest, but so relaxed. So non-assertive, non-manipulative, not trying to change anything, just like that. So it gives you the ambience. So at the beginning, whether it's a kestrel kiting into the wind, the old person watching other people's children play, and so on, or as one of the Sogyal Rinpoche's images, in that same practice, he said, be like a gracious host in the midst of unruly guests. It's one of my favorite ones also, okay? So in between sessions, image is very helpful. When you're actually practicing mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind, awareness of awareness, leave all the images behind. Just do the practice. Okay? As with the desire. Before, yes. After, yes. But during it, clean and simple. Okay? Good. There was another hand up. Yes. Yes, Sandra, please.
Almost every night...
Almost every night. Yes.
We listen to you tell us to allow our awareness to descend into our bodies.
Yeah.
And to do it as the first act of loving kindness.
Quite so.
So my question is, where the heck is it?
Where the heck is your awareness?
Yes. Where does it hang out?
Uh huh.
And is it some kind of dissociative disorder that we call culturally normative, that it's not with us all the time?
Yeah. Yeah. No, very interesting question. There are two very different words or assertions, and that is, on the one hand, what is normal and what is natural. And often those are conflated. Well, it's just normal to get angry if somebody is rude to you. And that's just natural. I mean, what else would you do? Get angry, of course, like that. But in Buddhism, when we speak of habitual and then we speak of natural, like settling the mind in its natural state, well, those are diametrically opposed, right? And so it's habitual. It's completely normal for people to, for us, not somebody else, but for us human beings, to wander around throughout the, you know, engage in our daily activities with the mind like a beehive, just swarming with one ruminative thought after another, one image after another, one just being yanked around by one obsessive compulsive thought after another, and it's normal. I know a professor at UC Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara. One of his major fields of research is mind wandering. Well, he certainly has a lot of material to work with, you know, because people are wandering most of the time, you know, and it's normal. Is it healthy? No, nothing healthy about it at all, you know, but it's habitual, it's normal. But natural is to overcome the habituation, the rut, and allow the mind to settle where we're seeking to settle it, and that is a quality that is relaxed, still, and clear, ready to engage in thought when it's worthwhile. But when it's not worthwhile, either very disciplined thought where we're planning something, remembering something, or whether it's allowing the thought just to go into freewheeling, like daydreaming, but very consciously, multiple options there. But when there's no need to think, having the option to simply be still and quiet. Right? So that's what's being cultivated here. But the norm is often very dissociative and very afflictive and unhealthy. So low self-esteem is very common nowadays, but that doesn't mean it's healthy. And having a mind that is just constantly caught up in one obsessive compulsive thought after another is very normal, but it's not healthy, right? So the other part of your question was, or your comment, trying to snag it out of my memory.
Where is it?
Where is it? Yeah. It's rather like asking where is the space of the mind. It's a very closely associated question. Where is the space of the mind? And the space of the mind, you will probably recall the response to that. The space of the mind is, well, where is it? Wherever there's a mental event, that's where the space of the mind is, right? And so if our thoughts are very small, I've spoken of the space of the mind crunching down, getting squished down, collapsing into, becoming literally quite small-minded as we get fixated in, trapped in some ruminating thinking, some resentment, some craving, some anxiety, and so forth. So that's where awareness is. The space of the mind collapses down to, if I'm just worrying about something, ruminating, anxious about something, where's my awareness? Right where I'm attending. That's where it is. That's where the space of the mind is collapsed down to. Now, in the practice we did, was it just yesterday, of in the awareness of awareness practice, expanding awareness upwards, to the right, to the left, down, out into space, where's your awareness? It's exactly where you placed it. If you shot your awareness way up into the space above you, that's where your awareness is. Your awareness is wherever you're attending, right? Now, a number of people have a sense of their awareness being up here. This is why I speak of letting your awareness descend. Because number one, all of our five physical senses are up here. The tactile sense, of course, pervades all the skin. But our eyes are up here, and sound, and smell, and taste. And then, of course, touch also. So we have all of them up here. And when I look at you, you know I'm looking at you, not when I'm staring at your knees or your feet. You might wonder, Alan, why are you looking at my feet? But if I look at your eyes, you don't wonder, why am I looking at your eyes? Your eyes are not a human being. Your forehead is not a person. But if I look right at your eyes, then you feel I'm looking at you. Right? Oh, there you are, right? And so, and it's from here that we hear things, but we are about 80% ocular people, that is ocularly oriented. It's a very, very strong orientation to vision. So there tends to be a sense of being located up here sensorily, and then cognitively, especially with all the indoctrination that the mind is the brain, the mind is the brain. Then, of course, we think our thoughts are up here too, that they're inside the head. And so it locates us all up here, or sometimes even sense maybe even a little bit above. And so the whole sense of descending is simply letting your awareness focus downwards until you're really simply having an immediate experience, a presence with, a total immediate engagement with the tactile sensations of your body against, in your case, the cushion on your chair, your feet on the floor, you're coming to the earth element. And for most of us, when that happens, we're going to have a feeling of descent, of coming down, descending, like that submarine that comes to settle on the sea floor, the ocean floor, like, And it's really have a sense of coming out of the head, right? So where is awareness? Wherever we're attending. And it can be inside the body. It can be locked up in the head. It can be also as vast as space. Awareness is wherever it is present, wherever it is cognizing. Something like that, yeah. Anything else coming up? Yes, Yin.
Just this question, I want to ask why we only layer, down, but not front and back.
It's a good question.
Second question.
No, one question at a time.
Okay.
You know me. I go into samadhi mode. You know, as soon as I hear the first question, I'm going in samadhi. Ah, there it is. And my mind goes like that. And then, you know, if I'm trying to answer the second question is gone. That's my limitation. So now, what was your question? So I think the reason for that is very. I've pondered it myself. So in this final phase of these. It can be three stages, it can be four stages, but the awareness of awareness, and I won't recapitulate because I'm sure you remember, but in that final phase, and it's in the final phase of the instructions by Padmasambhava, and it's the final stage in all of his teachings of shamatha, in this text, Natural Liberation, because he starts out with like putting a stick, a stone, or a flower in front of you, some physical object, and just looking at it and seeing if you can sustain your attention. So really easy and really coarse. Right, that's where it starts. And he knows it's coarse, but give people, give people something they can do. And don't start them out with something they can't do, like awareness of awareness. And then step by step, in the sequence of methods that he gives in his shamatha section of Natural Liberation, then the culmination, as you might recall, is awareness of awareness. And the culmination of that process, because that also goes through steps, he says, do this for one day, and then finally to this final one. Then he comes there, and you're directing your attention up. This is his interaction. Up into space, to the right, to the left, down, to the heart, and then supernova, just out into space. So, but why not forward and backward? We covered all the other directions. How come not forward and backward? I'll tell you my sense. Number one, it doesn't say. He doesn't say. So I can't say. Padmasambhava's answer is, he didn't give an answer. He just said, do this. And you'll achieve shamatha. Then you don't need to worry about it, right? But my sense of it, as I've reflected upon this, is prior to that point, already in stage 1, 2, 3, you're doing this practice, which really recurs in the Dzogchen tradition especially, this oscillation. Where does he start? He says, let your eyes be open. Let your gaze, your awareness, rest evenly in space. You can go check it. It's on the notes for the one-week retreat that I teach so often. Let your awareness come into space. Release it evenly into space with no object. Now, what is almost anyone going to do when you get that instruction? Let your eyes be open. Release your awareness into space. Leave it there evenly with no object. Where are you going to go? In front of you. Your eyes are open. Your eyes are in the front of the head, not the back of the head. And it says, have your eyes open, and here's space. Okay, release it there. Release your awareness into space, but with no object. But where are you going to go? You're going to go out, right in front of you. Almost everybody will do that, right? And so there you are, and you're resting for a little while, with no object, just being present. But you have a sense of having come out, right? And then he says, now concentrate. What is the very nature of the consciousness that is present? And what are you going to do? You're going to withdraw your awareness from all appearances. But where did you place your awareness in the first stage of the meditation? In front of you. So where are you going to withdraw? Away from in front of you. Back. So he's already got it covered. Now, he could have said, go behind your head, but I think that's kind of implicit. But since we are coming out in front, then in the first couple of stages, one can say three stages, where he says, release into space in front of you, and then withdraw your awareness in upon the very consciousness that is present. Then release again and concentrate again. And then he says, invert your awareness in upon the agent that is releasing and contracting the awareness. You come inward further. Maybe you're coming in behind your eyes by now. Because where are you? Where are you? Where are you, the agent that's in charge of your attention, that's directing it here and there? And then he says, observe yourself. Observe yourself. And you're probably going to be coming back this direction, right? And then release. So for most people, I think, when they're engaging in those first three phases, withdrawing into awareness, doing this cognoscopy into the nature of the agent, the person who's doing the meditation, drawing it right in upon the observer, and he says, observe yourself, and then release. There's going to be implicitly for most people some kind of a sense of a lateral movement. Out in front and back in, out in front and back in. Now, I find that a bit limiting. But number one, it's just bound to happen. And when I first started doing this practice, I was definitely doing that. So for some years even, when I was teaching those phases, I would say, let the oscillation be like a pendulum. And let it swing out, out into release, and then invert inwardly. And out. But I don't teach that anymore. Because it's too linear, and it's suggesting that the space is just in front of you. Well, it's not. So now I use more my hands like a lotus, and said, when you're releasing, release just out into space, but not just the space in front of you, out into space. And then withdraw from all appearances, not just the appearances in front, but from all appearances, and withdraw right into awareness. Release out into space. So I wanted to bring that three-dimensionality into it, because I think that really is core. But unless that statement is explicitly made, which I've been making now for, I guess, the last few years when I've been teaching this, unless we make an explicit point that it's more like a lotus opening or a sea anemone that opens and then contracts when you put your finger in it and then contract in upon itself, unless one makes a very specific, explicit point of this being three-dimensional, right, just out, then most likely one's going to be following that instruction out, in, out, in, right? So that covers that. The lateral movement in front and back is already covered in the first three stages. And then what's left over is up, down, right, left, into the heart, and then out in all directions. Okay? That's my sense of it. Okay? Good. Oh, now you had part two. Yeah, I did remember that part, that you had a second one.
Yeah. Second question is when we expand to layer, and then why we come back, why not the space stay there, the awareness, and then this extending there. So I mean, why we come back, then there disappear.
Uh-huh. Then it disappears because you're not attending to
then
it.
Come back.
And I can tell you why I teach it that way. Other teachers might teach it in a different way, like just expanding. And then while expanding, almost like an arc, now that your awareness has come up, now arc it to the right. You know, you do it, and then arc it to the left. And so now you've got like that. And now arc it down. So now you've got a 360 degree. You know, you could do it like, and I wouldn't say that's wrong. I wouldn't say it's wrong. But I will say why I teach it the way I do. And it's simply one way of teaching it. Again, the teachings always lend themselves to some degree of interpretation. Yeah? So why do I do it as I do? Up and then release. It's in the same spirit of the first three stages. And that is there is this extension. So there's an extension inwards. Come right in upon the observer, right in upon the agent, and then release. That oscillation. And this is characteristic of a lot of Dzogchen practices. Of the contraction. It's such a natural movement of contraction and release. Whether it's the big bang to the big crunch, big bang, big crunch on a universal level. Or, you know, it happens so many places in nature. It's an oscillation. And so that's what I feel really helps this elasticity of the awareness, the expansive awareness, is to stretch it up and then release. So now we're releasing in rather than contracting in, since we stretched up in the first place, and then release, and then stretch, and then release, stretch and release, stretch and release. Descend down to the heart and release, and then just release. So that's why I do it. It's in the spirit of the earlier three stages of that oscillation. And I find it very helpful, just overall, that theme. That's why I introduce it. I've taken this theme of oscillation, and I, legitimately or illegitimately, I've taken this theme because I find it so helpful, and it comes from great, great teachers. And I've inserted this into mindfulness of breathing. None of my Anapanasati teachers ever taught this, but it just strikes me as just fine. And that is when you're breathing in, let this be a time for really sharpening up, attending closely, and thereby overcoming laxity. When you're breathing out, a natural time to relax, to release, to let go very deeply as you breathe out, 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 out. Natural antidote for excitation. All right? So that's not taught. I've never heard that from any Theravada teacher. But it just seems so helpful that then I don't apologize for it. Right? So that inversion and release, until you get to the point And this is true in mindfulness of breathing, and it's equally true in awareness of awareness. Until you get to the point, and somebody asked me that just today, in terms of awareness, at what point can you stop with the release and the inversion? When do you stop doing that and just come and settle? That's a good question. And my answer is, when you feel like it. When you feel like it. When you feel, I understand the whole point of releasing and inverting, and I've done it, and I've done it. And then I'm inverting, I'm arousing, clarifying the attention, I'm releasing, I'm calming and soothing attention, remedying laxity, remedying excitation, until you find yourself settling into kind of an equilibrium. At that point, when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, you don't need to arouse or release anymore. You're in a flow, just a flow, like a current, like a stream. And there doesn't need to be any oscillation. You're in it. You're in flow now. And likewise, when you're practicing awareness of awareness, there comes to a point where you feel, that's enough. And now, it's not whimsy. It's not just I feel like it. But rather, when you've done it enough and you feel, okay, good, now, and you just come and rest right in the center. And it's not where my fingers are. It's the center is just letting awareness rest in its own place with no sense of coming in, no sense of going out, letting awareness just rest with no exertion, no out, no in, no object, no subject, just resting. And if you can do that, and when you do it, and you just rest, and here are the two phrases. Rigpa rangsar nepa, rigpa rangsar zimba. Awareness resting in its own place, awareness holding its own ground. But when you do that, let's do it right now with nobody moving. You don't need to change position. But just try it now. Just don't even need to change your hands. Just because you don't need to do anything. It's a matter of being, letting your awareness just be, rest in its own place. And having that confidence arise. This is it. This is doing the practice. All my words now are just fluff. They're noise. But they're noise coming after the effect. This is it. I'm doing it right. I've got it. And I can just sit there and I'm doing it. I'm knowing. I'm resting in awareness. I'm cognizant. I'm doing it in a continuous fashion. Of course, when I'm talking, I'm not. But that's all, again, noise after the fact. And knowing that just by doing that, resting in awareness, cognizant of being cognizant, that's enough to take you all the way down to the substrate consciousness. That's enough. And everything else is preamble. Okay? So there's some real satisfaction in that. It's so simple. It's deliciously simple. When you get there and you know you're doing it right and you have that confidence, and it's knowing like you've just put a lump of a burning coal on top of a mound of snow, and it doesn't have to do anything. Just put it on top of the mound of snow and watch what happens. And it will settle in its natural state. It will burn right through the coal, right through the mound of snow. And if it's hot enough, it's going to burn all the way down to the ground. Right? And your awareness will descend into its natural state. And you don't need to do anything. And so you will descend to it, or viewing it from the upside down, shamatha will rise up to meet you. Right? The innate stillness and the innate luminosity or vividness of your own substrate consciousness will rise up to meet you. Or you will descend to it, either way. Okay? Nice practice. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Anything else coming up? Yes, Barbara.
Alan, I'm always flummoxed when you have a...
You're always...
Flummoxed?
I'm missing that verb.
You're almost... Confused.
You're flummoxed? Is that the word?
Yes.
You're flummoxed. Yes, I like for the word flummoxed. Yes.
When you have us do this...
When you have a...
When you have us do the type of meditation that you had us do tonight, where we're supposed to decide what we don't have, what we need, what we want the world to give us. I mean, in particular, being here and seeing how these people live. And
yeah.
I mean, I spend every day in the back roads sometimes talking to people, but seeing how they live.
Yeah.
So what am I supposed to be asking for? Am I too easy to please, or do I not understand what you're really saying?
You got me. I'm flummoxed. there's no right answer to this. This is why I said if there are 40 people in the room, there are 40 meditations. But it's a very simple question. So it's a simple question, but there's no right answer. It's no right answer. It's a very personal question. And that is the first phase is how do you allow yourself to envision what would really make you truly happy? And again, maybe those are not the words that you would choose. Truly happy, maybe that's not it. What would give you satisfaction? Maybe that's not the word. What would you give the greatest sense of meaning? So I would rummage around in my vocabulary. Fulfillment, meaning, satisfaction, genuine happiness, and so forth. But what's your heart's desire? What would you really love to experience? You know? And so that's the first one. And to allow it to be different. There's no right answer. You know, there's no one right answer. And of course, as we mature spiritually, as our experience deepens, expands, then the very vision of what it means for us to flourish as individuals matures. It grows, expands. And so allow it to do so. That's why, there's not one right answer we keep on coming back to in each cycle of the 10 meditations. So there's the first one. And then we'll come to the second one. It's so practical. It's so embedded in life. And that is consider, do you have any mundane needs when you go back to Santa Barbara? Would you like to live in a cardboard box?
Chickens out front.
with a climate like Thailand, maybe not that bad. But, where you're actually going to be going back to the life that you will be leading, if that's where you want to go back, maybe you want to settle here. There are worse places to settle, as Klaus has found. But just generally, not focusing on this environment, that environment, but focusing on, what are your mundane, your hedonic needs? They should be met. Having enough to eat. Whether you're a Thai or an American, having enough to eat, that's good. So you cover those, and maybe you just cover those really snappy. Maybe you have enough saved up that you don't even have to think about it. God, it'll take place. But then allow, do you think, for you to live the most meaningful life you can that would give you the greatest fulfillment, are you in a position right now that you can do this entirely on your own? Now, I've known yogis who've spent 20, 30 years in retreat. And so what they need from the world around them is precious little. And I've lived with them, and I know what I needed at that time. I needed somebody once a week to bring me some food and a bit of kerosene for my stove. And once every 2 or 3 weeks, I really, really wanted to see His Holiness so I could receive His further counsel and guidance. That was it. I mean, food once a week. I cook my own foods, my little pan chapatis, and cook my dal and some veggies and whatever. That's all I needed. So that took care of the mundane, because I had four roofs and a leaky roof, and I had plenty of fleas and bed bugs and rats. And so I had plenty of company, I needed somebody to come up, because I really didn't want to have to go down there to the village to hike an hour and a half down to the village to receive goods. And I meant I need somebody to sell me some stuff. But I also very much needed the guidance in the practice. I was not so independent, so self-contained. But I've known yogis who are. I know yogis right now who, if they never receive any more instruction in this lifetime, they've got all they need. All they really need is, Genlam Rinpa, in one phase, you might recall. All he needed was a rock and 5 kilos of atta, 5 kilos of brown flour every month. That's what he needed. Right? But actually, he was also going out for teachings when he could. But he needed a rock, a little bit of shelter from the rain up there in Dalhousie. No, that was another town. But in any case, one of the hill stations in India. So the simple point there is, what would you love to receive so that you can live the most meaningful and fulfilling life you can? And it might be having companions. It might be having access to a teacher. It might have having a community. Some people would really like to have a community of people, spiritual friends, having a pleasant environment, and so forth. So I don't see this any as being very mysterious unless one thinks there's a right answer and I haven't found it yet. And when it's just recognized, it's your desires. It's your desires. What would you love to receive? So you have enough. So I phrase it, each time I've done it, I phrase it in the same way. Starting out, what would you love to receive? And some people might think, a 10-bedroom house and 2 cars in the garage. One of them should be a Porsche. You know, that's what I really love to receive, because when I drive, I want to drive in a really good car, you know. So some people might be a little bit extravagant. Could be, you know. But then when I go into the same meditation a bit further, and then I say, okay, now let's actually do it, then I rephrase it slightly. I say, start out with what would you love to receive? And then we actually do the meditation, and now imagine you receive all that you need. And you probably don't really need the Porsche, right? But then imagining that you actually are receiving everything you do need. And then the inner transformation and so on. But I think I'm not quite hitting the target. I'm doing as well as I can. But from your facial expression, I think I'm not quite hit the bullseye.
I might just be too easy to please.
Too
easy to please.
Oh, I don't think that's a problem.
I really think I have everything I need.
Good. Then what you can do, that is in terms of the receiving from the environment, then if you have everything you need, wouldn't it be wonderful if you continue to receive everything you need? Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't it be nice? You know, inside of Arbit, it gets cool sometimes. To have a sweater would be really handy. Or you'd actually be able to turn on the heat. But also, as one, insofar as one feels that one is really setting out on a path, and not just, I've got my Dharma practice, I'm practicing Dharma, but having a sense that I'm now following a path, and the path evolves, it unfolds, there are levels of practice, there are dimensions of practice, then one can envision, wouldn't it be wonderful as your own practice evolves, as your body, as your mind, as your heart expands, and you become a suitable vessel, you become ripe for more and more advanced teachings along the path. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have some spiritual companions along the way, friends, to be able to share your experiences, to learn from each other, perhaps have a guide, a teacher, or more than one teacher, be able to, as it were, take you by the hand and guide you along the path all the way to its culmination. Wouldn't that be lovely? I think so. Yeah. Okay. Good. Anything else coming up? Yes, Chaktor. The irrepressible Chaktor.
And one question from yesterday. Yesterday you told that when we are dreaming,
yes,
we have a different mind, something like a dreaming mind is coming from Rikpa.
Coming from the substrate.
Yeah.
Or substrate. The Yiganambashivi Gyuntamo, from the subtle continuum of mental consciousness. Yeah.
And
carry
do
on.
We have different awareness?
Yeah.
And it's quite different from that type of awareness which we have when we are not dreaming.
That's true, yes. Yes.
It was a question.
Yeah. So it's a statement and it's a true statement. There's an interesting point from Tibetan Buddhism. It's the place I've seen it most explicitly. And that is speaking of, in the Gelugpa terminology, they just say coarse consciousness, subtle consciousness, very subtle consciousness, or mind. Semrakpa tamo shinto tamo. So very common. And of course you know that when they speak of sem tamo, subtle mind, that this is equivalent to yiganambashivi yun tamo, the subtle continuum of mental consciousness, and that's equivalent to what in Dzogchen is called gunjinamshi, substrate consciousness. And I would suggest that this is the same as what is called in the Theravada tradition, bhavanga. Oh yeah. So an interesting theme from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, this is where I've learned it from, is that we have the coarse mind, which is the psyche. It's really what psychologists study. It's a coarse mind. It's one we're operating with during all of the waking state. There's a subtle mind, but the subtle mind in this broad category also includes dreaming. It's not just the quiet substrate consciousness, but dreaming consciousness is considered also to be more subtle than ordinary coarse mind. And then there's a very subtle mind. Well, then it's down to innate mind of clear light, rikpa, pristine awareness. So the theme that comes out is that the more subtle the mind is that you're operating from, that you're using, the more powerful it is, and therefore, in terms of spiritual practice, potentially the greater benefit. And so overall, if you can be meditating from the platform or from the basis of dreaming consciousness as your base, And imagine that you're in the midst of a dream, you become lucid, that's pretty important, that you're dreaming and you recognize you're dreaming. From that vantage point, it's said to be more effective from that platform, that context, if you then engage in, let's say, state regeneration practice, and you dissolve all phenomena into emptiness, you arise to the deity, and you do the whole sadhana within the dream. It's more powerful than just in the waking consciousness, right? Number one, your visualization ability is probably much better, and it can be done. So when I did my first shamatha retreat under His Holiness in 1980, He gave me a shamatha practice within the context of Vajrayana, state regeneration practice. Very, very demanding. And so I was doing it, I was doing about 10 hours a day, I think. I'm trying to remember how many sessions. But each session would always be embedded in the sadhana. And I was doing it multiple times, sometimes short version, sometimes long version. And I remember I was so immersed in the practice that when I was dreaming, then I would also start doing the sadhana. And in the midst of the dream, I was asking, does this count? Good quantitative mind. So, I think it was another Lama, I think it was Dzogchen Rinpoche, that commented that when you're doing the practice of the dreams, the mind just works a lot better. So if you're studying in the dream, your mind will be much more supple. It's subtler and therefore more powerful. So overall, if you can utilize the dream state, and the way to utilize it is to know that you're dreaming, then the practice you can do there will be generally more potent than your ordinary state of consciousness when you're in the waking state. But between dreaming and non-dreaming sleep, the non-dreaming sleep is more subtle than the dreaming sleep. So generally we'll call that category subtle. But then there's coarse subtle and subtle subtle. And the non-dreaming sleep, that's more subtle, therefore more powerful. So if you can be lucid while you're in just dreamless sleep, that also can be very potent for meditating on emptiness, for realizing the substrate consciousness, and so forth. Very potent. Or actually going from there to realizing Rigpa. Beyond that, of course, even more subtle and therefore more profound and powerful is the deepest dimension. So Rigpa, or like that. And of course, that's the deepest platform to work from. So on that note, since there's no hands up right... Oh, and we only have 3 minutes. I think it's about time. We're getting pretty close to halfway through the retreat. That for those of you, now that you're, I think, pretty well in stride, that is in the rhythm, in the flow of your practice, is no longer novel, it's no longer new and fresh, and you don't kind of get it. I think a lot of you are you're at least into at least one of the shamatha methods. I think now as a little dessert, a little ornamentation for your practice, should you be so inclined, and it's absolutely not imperative, it's not critical or indispensable, but if you would like, especially those who are expert sleepers like Alan, if you would like to kind of move in the direction of exactly this direction, of being able to utilize that roughly one-third of your life, right? So if you live to the age of 90, if you're not a lucid dreamer, you only really live 60 years, because the other was just either ignorant or deluded, right? You're just ignorant if you're deep asleep and you're not aware of it, then you're just ignorant. But if you're dreaming, then you're not only ignorant, but you're also deluded. Because you don't think you're dreaming, therefore you think it's something it's not. So you basically are screwed up one-third of your life. That's a big habit to break, right? So, to be able to develop, to move in the direction of being able to have a practice that just encompasses 24 hours, then that would entail during the waking state, being aware that you're awake and knowing what's going on. And in the dreaming state, recognizing that you're dreaming, and when you're in deep sleep, dreamless sleep, knowing that you're in deep dreamless sleep. In other words, going from a state of knowing to a state of knowing, rather than a state of quasi-knowing to a state of delusion or to a state of not knowing at all, which is deep sleep, non-lucid. So to move in that direction, some of you I know have begun this, a number of you have already had some lucid dreams in this retreat without any prodding or encouragement from me. But this is where the merging, the coming together of modern techniques within the scientific community can really be a very nice stepping stones to the very deep practices of dream yoga that we find originating in India and then really then being brought over the Himalayas to Tibet. And so, but the practical techniques for modern lucid dreaming, they are really so accessible and not intimidating or daunting that I suspect a number of you can, you know, begin, especially now that you're settled in, jet lag is mostly over. Most of you are in reasonably good sleep cycles by now. And so to begin that, I'll give you a very simple exercise now that I have 1 minute left before 6 o'clock. And that is, if you wish, as you're falling asleep, it's now time to start practicing prospective memory. And that is, it's memory like having a fishing rod and fly fishing and casting the fly out into the pond, maybe 50 feet out there. But, and then it lands. And what I'm inviting you to do is take the fly rod of your attention and cast it into the future as you're falling asleep, you know, while you're still conscious, of course. And what you're doing is, what I'm suggesting you do right now is a pretty easy, this should not be daunting or utterly impractical, is as you're falling asleep, cast your attention forward to remember something. And that is, once you're asleep, you won't probably know it unless you fall asleep lucidly, but after you become asleep and you're just waking up, when you just have that sense that, oh, retrospectively, you're recognizing, I must have been asleep, I was asleep, and now you're waking up. As soon as you see, this is where you cast your attention forward in anticipation and resolve. As soon as you start to have that sense of emerging from sleep into the waking state. Okay? So this calls for introspection, monitoring the state of your consciousness. When you see you're emerging from sleep into the waking state, recognize it as soon as you can. And as soon as you recognize that you are waking up, better to recognize it while you're waking up rather than, I'm awake, you know. While you're waking up, recognize you're waking up. And now, first of all, having recognized it, relax. Heard that one before? Relax. And don't move. Physically, don't move. Don't move a muscle. Just relax. Stay still. And then relax more deeply as you let your awareness do something we've not done before. And that is, let your awareness fall back. Not back into the body, fall back into your most recent memory. And the chances are quite high that you are just emerging from some dream. Let your awareness fall back into the last, as if you were watching a video, fall back into the last scene. And fall back into the scene before that. See if you can, as if you're picking up a novel that you put down and then, oh yeah, where was I? And oh yeah, this is the last thing that happened. Okay, I'm back in the novel. See if you can let your awareness fall back into the imagery, back into the narrative. And allow yourself, since you are just starting to wake up, unwake up, slip right back into the dream. And see if you can slip back as if you're tiptoeing back. Slip back into the dream lucidly, knowing that you're dreaming. Okay? The easiest way to have a lucid dream, to deliberately generate a lucid dream, is to slip back into it lucidly and then let the dream, almost like you've just caught a wave as a surfer, slip back into it and then let the wave of the dream carry you forward into the next chapter of the dream, but lucidly. Okay? If you find that you can't fall asleep, and that's very, very possible, what you should be able to do is, as you're waking up, do recognize that you're waking up, and do not move. That you should be able to do. Even tonight, shouldn't be that hard. Don't move. And if you can't fall asleep, don't worry about it. But see if you can retrace and recall the last image, and the image before that, and the story before that, and see if you can recall that last dream. Take an interest in it. See if you can retrieve it. Just that. Okay? That's the first step. So not too hard, I think. Okay? You want to try that? I mean, I won't be quizzing anybody on this. But it's a step towards becoming lucid in the dream. And I can tell you, a number of you have already had the experience of being lucid in dreams. But developing that ability, it's a skill to be developed, like a backswing in tennis. It's a skill that can be developed. Some people do it very easily. Some people have a harder time, but it can be developed. Once you've had to start having some lucid dreams, I think you'll find it very well worth the effort. Because it's very interesting and can be a very meaningful experience to be lucid in a dream. Okay? Au revoir. Have a good night. See you tomorrow morning.